I can't remember the last time I enjoyed a book start to finish the way I have enjoyed Ben Golliver's new book called Bubble Ball, Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season. Ben Golliver covers the NBA for the Washington Post, and he was one of a small number of journalists who was actually on hand and living and working inside the so-called bubble of the NBA, which allowed the NBA to finish out its otherwise truncated 2019-2020 season. And it was a remarkable development on so many levels. And that period, that is that bubble season, was punctuated by the shooting of Jacob Blake. And, of course, that dramatic event, so familiar to WGTD listeners, also had a powerful impact on the NBA and on its players in the midst of that dramatic season. And all of this and more is covered thoroughly in this fascinating book published by Abrams Press, again titled Bubble Ball, Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season. Ben Golliver, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, I'm so glad to be here, and I really appreciate your opening statement. Look, this book was a absolute passion project of mine for the last year or so. It's consumed so much of my time, so I'm glad I reached somebody. It really feels great to hear you say that.
I just can't get over it. And I should also add parenthetically, I'm not necessarily all that fervent a basketball fan, although I am a great Bucks fan, but I really do not follow the game nearly as closely as I follow several other sports. But this story in and of itself is so incredibly compelling. And I guess what I'm really trying to say is this book, I think, is tremendously interesting, even if one is not all that interested in the game of basketball. It's such a human drama on so many other levels besides the actual game of basketball as it's played out on the court. Did you intend it to be that kind of a book with that kind of wide sweep?
Absolutely. I didn't have a choice. I mean, as you're mentioning, the last season in the NBA was so dramatic for lots of different reasons. You had a controversy with Hong Kong and China pulling out, upset about some pro-Hong Kong tweets by one of the NBA's executives. You had the tragic death of Kobe Bryant. You had the death of former commissioner David Stern, one of the biggest figures in the history of the sport. You had the pandemic shutdown in the middle of the season, and you had this very almost goofy at times, but also, serious comeback plan at Disney World, where they're trying to, ultimately generate $1 billion of television revenue and try to crown a champion and save the season. So for me, it was just a perfect opportunity to write a time capsule book, and the layers were pretty much, right there for the taking. I didn't have to invent them. There was a business story. There was a public health story. There was the basketball story, of course. And I am a basketball diehard, so I view this as a basketball book, but it's a reminder that the sport touches all aspects of society. And there was plenty of other twists and turns along the way, including the social justice activism, which winds up, I think, really being the heart of the book, in my opinion, surrounding that Milwaukee Bucks decision not to take the court. So there was a lot going on. Last year is a most memorable year I've had covering the NBA since I started in 2007. And frankly, I think it was the most memorable year of my life. I'm 37. I don't really know what I would compare it to. And for that reason, I was hoping for future basketball fans, but also just, future people who want to look back at what the pandemic was like, through this sports lens. Hopefully this book will be able to capture that for them.
Right. Well, and it's an amazing story of innovation and cooperation, at least for the most part. And that, of course, has played out time and time again, whether it's in the NBA or it's the Metropolitan Opera or whoever or whatever it is trying to function and move forward in the midst of this pandemic. Another thing about the book that I really appreciate, and I've seen words of praise in a number of reviews of the book saying the same thing, is that this book is also about you. That is, yes, you do not take pains to kind of remove yourself, but this is also the story of what it was like for Ben Golliver to live and work in this bubble. Was that a decision you made right from the start, or was that a decision, in a sense, made for you by others?
Well, that's a great question. So when I went down into the bubble, my thought was not about writing a book. My thought was, am I going to be safe? Am I going to be okay from a health standpoint? So that was where all of my attention was. You know, I remember getting onto the flight cross country. I had a face shield and a mask, rubber gloves. I mean, I looked like I was ready to be a hazmat, supervisor. And once I got there, it became clear this was just such a different and extraordinary experience that, you know, basically no one else was living. In some ways, it was a more extreme version of what we were all going through in terms of the isolation and quarantine. But in others, it was just, you know, very quirky, right? You know, you walk out of your hotel room door, and this is at Disney World where people are typically going to vacation, and there's an NBA All-Star, and he's just, you know, saying, hello, welcome to the bubble. And here's another one fishing off of a dock, right? And, you know, here's another one driving a golf cart around in circles because there's not much else to do on this this restricted campus environment. And meanwhile, we are being just inundated with health and safety protocols to keep us safe. So we're getting tested every single day. We have to fill out a questionnaire about our symptoms. We have to wear a device around our neck that beeps if we get too close to each other to establish social distancing. We had electronic monitoring bracelets, which would get us into our hotel room, but could also track us around campus. We dealt with four levels of security, from the NBA to Disney security to local police. The campus that we lived in had physical boundaries that we could not leave. There was video surveillance and signs everywhere saying you are being video surveilled. So there was a real Big Brother aspect to it, too. And so as I was writing some of my first stories for the Post, I was actually getting encouraged for the first time from my Post editors, put yourself into this, you know, make this almost like a diary, you know, write it first person. And for me, I actually have a creative writing background rather than a journalism background. So it was kind of a natural thing for me to do. And we just found that those stories were the ones that people were really interested in terms of readership numbers and all of that. And pretty quickly after that, I heard from, actually the book publisher and the agent saying, hey, this shouldn't just be a diary. This should be like a book-length version of this experience. And for me, writing in the first person helped me humanize the players. You know, it was very easy for people to criticize these players and say, well, they're complaining about their mental health, but come on, they're living at Disney World for 3 months. How bad could it be? And I consider myself a pretty low-maintenance person. You know, I live in a one-bedroom apartment. I drive a Ford. But when I was out there, I mean, I put on weight. I slept terribly. My anxiety was definitely up. I had feelings of isolation from my family members 3,000 miles away. And so I felt like if I shared that story, you know, kind of more like a common man, everyman type of story, I'm not some big, you know, millionaire basketball player. And I think maybe people would be able to relate to my experience maybe a little bit better than they could with the NBA players and realize that, you know, we were all kind of going through these challenges together. But the other reason I chose first person, just to wrap this quickly, is that I'm a diehard basketball fan, and I felt like I won the golden ticket to, like, Willy Wonka's basketball factory. And so I wanted anyone who does really love the sport to feel like they could ride along with me. And, you know, some of those moments of wonder where I get to sit courtside, you know, it's almost like I get to be Rihanna or Jack Nicholson for a summer, right, and have those amazing courtside seats. I wanted to bring, you know, basketball fans as close as possible to the action because I just felt, you know, especially when I was doing my job, you know, the work aspects of it, I just felt so incredibly lucky to have that great access. So that was the decision on the first person, and it surprised a lot of people, surprised a lot of my colleagues, I think. But I tried to be as honest as possible with my own journey because I think that, you know, lets you know the kinds of, you know, ethical decisions you have to weigh when you want to give up your medical privacy for the ability to participate in a protective bubble, or, you know, just the decisions of, you know, leaving family and what is that like. And so I thought it worked better if it was personalized rather than just, you know, kind of a straight newspaper style account.
I applaud the choice wholeheartedly. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with the Washington Post's Ben Golliver about his brand new book called Bubble Ball, Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season. So in many respects, all of this begins, that is, this specific story begins on the 11th of March, 2020, which is the first occasion that an NBA player tests positive for COVID, and in quite dramatic fashion, a game that is supposed to be played is called off, and very soon thereafter, the season itself is put on indefinite hiatus. As you describe the start of this story, the sense we get is that the NBA, for all that they knew about COVID and the almost inevitable dimensions of what was going to overtake them, was really not prepared for this. I mean, really, in some respects, caught unaware. Can you just kind of help us understand how such a thing would be possible? to, in a sense, both know and not know, or understand and yet not understand what was coming.
Absolutely. So let me draw a distinction. I think the NBA league office was aware of the impending pandemic, right? They were tracking this thing from China months in advance, giving out detailed accounts and reports to their teams about, hey, this is what this could mean and so forth. The issue with the NBA is that, you know, it's a collection of 30 organizations owned by 30 owners. And those owners may have different political beliefs. They may have different opinions on just about everything under the sun. And, you know, just like any other organizing body, whether it's the House of Representatives or the Senate, you got to get everybody on board, right? And so when you're discussing like, hey, we might want to shut down our season here to deal with this pandemic, you're going to have some owners who are like, yes, that's in the best interest of our fans, safety. We want to make sure we keep our players healthy. And you're going to have others who are saying, wait a minute. Why are we going to put ourselves out of business? We should be waiting for the government to tell us to not, you know, if it's really not that safe, why isn't the federal government saying you guys can't play, right? And so there was a tension there that was unfolding in real time. And you'll remember how quickly things hit last March, right? I mean, there was a few early tests, but then all of a sudden, boom, it's like New York is just completely besieged by this virus. And so they were trying to adapt in real time. But to me, it was, the key hangup was just a sense of a denial. No one wants to believe that this larger-than-life invisible force is going to completely shut down their business for good and cost them billions and billions of dollars. Like, all of us are going to hope for, you know, the best in our own lives. And so for me as a writer, again, to personalize it, I was still taking trips around the country trying to report stories and knowing that, hey, this is a little bit risky. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this, but thinking, you know, maybe it won't happen to me, or if it becomes so unsafe, they won't let me get on a plane, right? You're going through those kinds of rationalization processes. And so I actually give the NBA credit for acting swiftly once there was a positive test, because that really started a chain reaction from other leagues. But certainly there were owners and representatives of teams within the league that thought they should have acted even more quickly, and they never should have gotten to a point where, you know, a health executive for one of the teams is running onto the court just moments before tip-off to tell the referees, hey, we have a positive test. These guys shouldn't be playing tonight. You know, that seemed a little bit too late. You know, in hindsight, you kind of wish there would have been a little bit more proactivity there. But ultimately, their decision to shut down was a big one. It cost them, it's probably going to be about $5 billion between last year and this year together. That's no small amount of money. And to put the bubble together actually cost them an additional $200 million just to construct this environment for people to live in. And so these were very, very difficult kind of foundational, fundamental questions about stay open or don't stay open. And the NBA was living out those questions kind of before everybody else, because before not too long, the government did say, hey, you know, you guys can't have restaurants open indoors, right? And they did issue shutdown orders and stay-at-home orders across the country. So it was a head-spinning time. And looking back on my reporting sort of day by day, that story changed just so quickly. And I would point out the conflicting messages from the federal government made everything more difficult, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't have a clear sense of what the threat level was. There were some comments made by former President Trump that he didn't want to, you know, stoke a panic. He wanted to kind of keep everybody calm by sort of sitting on some of this information. He told Bob Woodward that. And I think, you know, in hindsight, there was a way to better prepare the entire country and the NBA universe itself. And me personally, I think if we had clearer communication during that time period.
It's interesting how you describe your reaction to the announcement from Commissioner Adam Silver that the NBA was shutting down. You write, this was crushing news, but my first reaction was a deep sigh of relief. I mean, what an interesting mix, and I think we understand what you're saying there, but you go on very, very quickly thereafter to say, when the arenas went dark, my life got dark. That is, for you professionally, this was in some ways a catastrophe. I mean, not that you suddenly lost your job, but in a sense, you sort of lost your beat or what your beat had been. In fact, at another point, you say the biggest sports stories were evaporating before my eyes. I mean, what you should have been covering suddenly wasn't occurring. Can you just say a word about what it was like for you as a journalist to find yourself in this really strange, painful scenario?
Absolutely. So the relief came from the idea that the very next night after the shutdown, I was supposed to go cover a game in Los Angeles at the Staples Center between the Lakers and the Rockets. And I was really looking forward to the actual basketball, but I was very nervous at that point about, you know, am I going to be walking into the lion's den, quote unquote, of germs, right? Or the virus. And sure enough, in the weeks that followed, it became clear that some players who were in Los Angeles at that same arena, Brooklyn Nets players and LA Lakers players, did test positive that week at a game, or, you know, they were in the building for a game, I should say. We don't know exactly when they were contracting the virus. So the threat was very real. And that's where the relief came from. It was this idea of, like, here I am sort of dodging bullets. You know, I went on a trip earlier that week to Minnesota and I came back and I was okay. No symptoms. I felt very relieved. Now I don't have to go into the office. So it's like, you know, it's okay. It's work from home mode. And I felt relieved. But it dawned on me that, look, you know, all I really care about, my entire life is structured around this sport, basketball. If there's no games, if there's no transactions, no trades, you know, sort of what's my purpose? It was a very existential moment for me. And I'll be honest, I didn't handle it great. You know, the first couple of months I was out, you know, I was up out of bed, you know, 5:30 a.m., which is very atypical for me. And I'm walking, you know, miles and miles around my neighborhood with the mask on just to burn off some of the stress and, you know, trying to figure out, okay, like, where is this thing headed? But it did become pretty clear, you know, within a weeks, I would say, not like a week, but within weeks, that the NBA did want to try to salvage this thing if they could, right? And so then the story changed. It wasn't a story anymore about wins and losses on the court. It was, okay, how can the NBA put something together where, you know, it's going to be taken credibly, they're going to be able to protect the players. And, you know, even before the actual shutdown, my brain was already kind of going that direction because I had seen what happened in China with how they were trying to save their sports. So I was even trying to concoct bubble scenarios in my mind about how many teams would you bring, how long would it have to last, where would you place it to keep maximum safety. And so there were certainly things to kind of like occupy my brain during that time period, but it was very dark and very sad. And part of the reason for that, I watch these players in terms of how they prepare for games up close, and I am just blown away by their day-to-day commitment to their bodies and to their crafts. And the idea that they were going to get three quarters of the way through the season and then just not have a payoff, it made me so sick to my stomach, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, when you're reading the book, you want to read it to the final page, right? When you're doing a project, you want to have it, you know, presented and, you know, out into the world. And the idea that it would be unfinished, it really just did not sit right with me. And I could tell the NBA league office and some of the superstar players felt the exact same way. And I think that's why you had this bubble scenario, because they said, look, we're not quitters, right? We don't really know a ton about this virus, but we're going to learn about it. We're going to invest whatever it takes to try to find a way to combat it in this environment. And then once we're on the court, we're going to pick up where we left off and play as hard as possible. And that's actually exactly what happened. Of course, that took, you know, 4 months of a shutdown to play out. And those were four very long, agonizing months, you know, for me and for a lot of basketball fans, because there's just nothing on TV. But they did succeed in the goal. And, you know, I just tip my hat to all of them for their sacrifices. You know, that was the phrase NBA Commissioner Adam Silver used at the very end of the bubble. He said, everyone here has made, quote unquote, enormous sacrifices. And I think that that is, you know, one of the major legacies here. A lot of people put their own personal comfort aside to make this project happen.
If I read my notes correctly, you wrote a column for the Washington Post on the 14th of March in which you created a scenario by which the NBA could resume its season in a way that at least roughly resembles what ultimately was created with this kind of bubble scenario. So first of all, am I right that that was a column on March 14th, which would be just a couple of days after the season had been suspended?
Correct. And I had actually been talking about these ideas on podcasts even before the season was shut down, because I was getting into this like almost paranoid protective impulse of like, how can I save the sport? And of course, it's not my sport to save, but you could tell my investment level is high. And I think in my original proposal, I was thinking about doing it in Las Vegas because that's where the NBA holds its summer league. And that's another similar event where you just have games going all day long and, you know, you bring everybody into adjacent gyms. And I just thought, well, look, you kind of have the blueprint for a bubble. You just make it like summer league, but then you have to restrict where the players can go when they're not playing. And you just almost turn it into like this basketball game factory. And, you know, I realized that, you know, most of the money that the NBA brings in, or the most important revenue stream, especially if you can't have fans in buildings, is television. So I knew this whole thing would be driven by the ability to put content on TV. And, you know, the one piece that I did not predict in that column was Disney's influence, because, you know, the NBA is partners with Disney through its relationship with ESPN and ABC. Bob Iger, you know, the head of Disney, has very close relationships, not only with Adam Silver, the head of the NBA, but also Chris Paul, the head of the Players Association. And so that wound up being a connective tissue that I never really saw developing. And ultimately, that's why they went down to Disney World, because it was a win for Disney to fill up all these hotel rooms for 3 months, and they had the basketball facilities ready to be used. So I didn't predict that part of it. But in terms of the standard format of how they would play, having teams go every other day, trying to keep it as tight as possible so you can get, you know, people pretty much in and out, and then restricting access to everybody outside, all those things came to fruition. But again, I was building my model on, you know, some of what I was reading about what was going on in Asia as they were trying to continue playing sports. They were just a couple months ahead of us, because obviously the pandemic hit them before it came to America.
One of the things I especially appreciated about what you said in that column is that it made clear to me something that I don't think I had understood until I read these words, and that's the fact that I think for a lot of us, when we thought about these NBA players going into some kind of protective bubble, it was to just kind of protect them from the outside world. But the thing I never stopped to think about was that by creating a single neutral site, which is everybody's home court, then you eliminate travel. And that was
correct.
Such a huge part of this, that it, you don't want NBA players flying here and there and everywhere in the midst of a pandemic. That is a recipe for disaster. That's why they needed to all be in one place. I mean, and that one place, of course, needed to be carefully isolated. But that singular location was crucial to all of this working.
It absolutely was, and I knew that was the case because I have to fly a lot every year, right? So for about 3 months, you know, during the playoffs, I'm just kind of crisscrossing the country, and inevitably I get sick at some point, right? I mean, I try to take all the precautions in the world, but if you fly a lot, you just know that's going to be how, you know, part of the game. And so I realized very quickly, like, that's the number one thing that has to go. You can't have a travel experience, especially if you're having players who, you know, they tend to go out and socialize on the road quite a bit, and that's also very risky. So the single site thing was like guaranteed to be the foundation of it. The question was just, where do they do it? And the genius of doing it at Disney World, and it's funny because I don't really like Disney movies personally. I don't have any kids, and I hate amusement parks. I hate standing in lines. I'm very, very impatient. So for me, the idea of Disney World at first, it was like this big groan moment of like, oh no, am I going to have to go live in Disney World for 3 months? But it actually wound up, you know, really exceeding my expectations, because they have what's called the ESPN Wide World of Sports Complex down there, and they host all sorts of high school tournaments, whether it's volleyball, basketball, all these other different sports, year-round in that complex. But, of course, it was also empty because of the pandemic. So they had all the sports facilities they really could have needed right next to all the hotels that they could have needed, and it was all private property, which was also crucial because in Las Vegas, again, like if the players are staying on the Strip, you couldn't just rope off the Strip and say, okay, well, now it's going to be the NBA playoffs. I mean, that would never work, you know, kind of functionally. But in Disney World, because it was all empty, they could just say, well, this property right here, let's put up a barrier around it. Let's make sure we have police officers out front. Now that's protected. Nobody comes in. Nobody comes out. Everyone has to wear credentials. And so they had the combination of the living quarters and the sports facilities all in the same single site. They used charter buses to kind of take us back and forth between the two places. And we had no ability to drive ourselves anywhere or to walk off campus or anything like that. And, you know, those very simple logistics held up for 3 straight months because not a single person who was living in the bubble tested positive while they were in the bubble, which is just an incredible achievement from a public health standpoint. And that tells you how rigorous the rules were. But it also tells you, like, you know, this is how strict the boundaries were around these areas, because at the time, Florida was going through quite a spike in COVID numbers. And, you know, that was part of my concern when I went down there is, am I going straight into a hotspot? And as it turned out, we were living on basically the safest place on earth at that point.
Mm. We're speaking with Ben Golliver about his book, Bubble Ball, Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season. Your book explores at least some of what we know about the intense negotiations behind closed doors in terms of coming to some kind of agreement, and both players and owners. I mean, the owners had to agree, and then the players had to agree, and none of that was going to be an easy matter. Ultimately, a plan is hammered out, and I think you tell us that of the 30 owners, 29 vote yes. Only one owner voted against the plan, and it needed 3/4, so it easily passed, and ultimately the players' union agrees to the plan. Briefly, just sketch kind of what the range of possibilities were, particularly when it came to the matter of who should participate. I mean, that is how many teams should be part of this bubble season. And the decision, which ultimately was a different decision than the one that I think you would have made had it been your decision to make.
Yeah, well, I was thinking short and sweet and just bring the 16 playoff teams, get them in, get them out, crown the champion, and we can all call it a success. And, you know, we only stay for 2 months, and it's nice and clean and easy. And what I didn't take into account was that, you know, each of those individual teams had television responsibilities with its local networks, right? So not only are Milwaukee Bucks games going to be on ESPN and ABC, but they also air locally. I think it's Fox Sports with Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken. And so there is obligations there to play more games to kind of fulfill those contracts so that you're not, you know, racking up these debts, you know, metaphorically to these local television providers. So what they came up with was an idea of basically bringing 22 teams, so more than just the 16 for the playoffs, having them play enough regular season games to get warmed up, but also to fulfill those television contracts, and then proceeding to the playoffs like usual, with a little twist of adding in a play-in round just to create a little bit more excitement for the last playoff seed. So they left 8 teams at home. The teams that were left at home were mostly okay with it. There were a few that wanted to be able to just kind of get their players some developmental opportunities, but those teams were pretty much also ran. They had no shot in the standings, and so it wasn't that big of a deal. Some of them were relieved not to be participating and made that clear. But for the teams that did go, 22 teams battled out for 16 playoff spots. And, it was a kind of a process of elimination, right? So we all got there in early July. And, you know, by early August, you'd already had 6 of the 22 sent home. And then by mid-August, you know, just 2 weeks later, you had lost another 8 teams because they had just played the first round of the playoffs. So pretty quickly you went from 22 to 8 teams, you know, within the first, like, I think 5 or 6 weeks. And so I think that's really what they did the calculation and said, hey, we don't have to keep this gigantic bubble going for that long, right? If we can just survive the first couple of weeks while everyone's still really closely paying attention to these rules, the bubble will just naturally shrink as teams get eliminated. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, by the end of the experience, it was pretty funny. I mean, it was already a ghost town in Disney World because there was no tourists there. But after we got about halfway through and there's only like 8 teams left and then down to 4 teams, I mean, it was post-apocalyptic to the point where it actually felt like some of the animals were reclaiming the territory. You know, I would go off on these walks around campus. I saw deer. I saw alligator. I saw hawks. I saw, you know, bugs the size of my fist, you know, Florida-sized critters. It was almost like the animals were reclaiming the Magic Kingdom. And, you know, that really brought a big smile to my face because I'm from Oregon and I like the outdoors a lot. But that just gives you a sense. You know, I promise you right now, if we went back to the same spot, there'd be tourists everywhere and those animals are back hiding in the nearby forest, right? Yep. So I think that's sort of how they came to the idea of 22 teams. It was all financially driven, and to their credit, their rules held up and it worked.
You also tell us that no individual player would be forced to participate. And there were some players who did opt not to be part of this, even though their teams were part of this. But that basically all of the key players, the marquee players, all agreed to this. At this point, we need to talk about something that I don't think we've yet touched on, which is the mechanism that allowed you to be one of a relatively few number of reporters on site covering this bubble season from within the bubble. Just briefly sketch for our listeners the process that was involved, and maybe also say a word about the really big scare that occurred kind of halfway through the process for you.
Well, it was a very intensive application process. I should note up front that because media members were going to be living in the bubble, and they would need to have daily COVID tests done. They need to have the hotel room. They would need to have the transportation costs and food costs all kind of bundled together. It was a $54,000 price tag for that 93-day stay for me in the Disney World, you know, for my employer, the Washington Post. And so you can tell right there, that price tag was prohibitive for a lot of media outlets, right? I mean, that's more money than I made for a number of years covering the NBA earlier in my career. I mean, more than my salary, right? And so that was the first step of, okay, like, how many outlets can even afford that much money in this day and age? And it was really limited to major national outlets for the most part, with a few regional papers and city papers, you know, dotted in along the way. So we had to send in all sorts of health information about ourselves. We had to, you know, go through the application process. There was only 10 slots for independent media members, you know, in other words, people not affiliated with the official television partners. And so I felt really fortunate to grab one of those spots. But, you know, midway through my process, as I'm applying, you know, I've actually had heart surgery twice for a congenital defect. And, you know, at the very last moment, I got a message saying, hey, you know, you're not approved to come down here. We need to hear from your cardiologist. And, you know, of course, you know, pardon the pun, but my heart skipped about three beats. You know, I was so excited and ready and kind of mentally prepared to get down to Disney World. But now I had to track down this note just to, you know, even get my approval. And thankfully, it all worked out. But I did not find out that I was officially accepted into the bubble until less than 24 hours before my flight to Orlando. And so you can imagine how nerve-wracking of an experience that was, you know, given that I had to fly cross country, you know, during this pandemic and didn't really know what I was getting into. And so for me, I'll never forget, you know, that run up. And it's a reminder of how quickly they did put this whole thing together. It did take months for them to get the player's approval, given how restrictive life was going to be. And I also want to point out, any individual player was free to leave the experience. In other words, you're not truly a hostage. Like, if you couldn't take it, or if you weren't feeling good about it or whatever, you could leave. But collectively, the players were really bound to this experiment. If they had decided to leave as a group, the owners could have torn up the collective bargaining agreement and said, look, you know, there's been a pandemic. Our previous financial agreements just don't apply anymore. We've got to make a new deal. And so the players had lots and lots of financial incentive. If they wanted their current contracts to be honored, they had to show up. And so as a group, they absolutely were bound to be down there. And we saw that after the Milwaukee Bucks protest that, you know, ultimately they had another decision. Do we stay or do we go? And they decided to stay. And I think a major reason they decided to stay, again, was the financial implications of what would happen if they did collectively leave.
You spell out that only 35 people from each of the 22 teams was permitted to travel to Disney World, no more than 17 players per team, and then a sundry staff. And it sounds like that was also very specifically outlined in terms of what staff was deemed necessary and permitted to be there. But something that I think a lot of us wouldn't even think about is the fact that basically for all of these players, none of their kind of private support staff would be permitted to be there. And that included family. But beyond that, those that had personal trainers and personal chefs and I mean, who knows what else, that these players were stripped of all of that. What kind of a significance do you think that was for the typical NBA player who was used to that?
Well, absolutely. It was a huge lifestyle change for these guys. I think it was actually the accommodations as much as the support staff. I mean, a lot of these NBA players at this point, especially the stars, I mean, they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And when you're in that sort of a lifestyle, you can have a really, really nice house. You can have really, really nice cars, right? And in Disney World, they're basically getting just standard hotel rooms, right? I mean, mine looked like your typical Courtyard by Marriott hotel, right? And so for me, not a huge adjustment, right? For these players, a big time adjustment. And, you know, it would be, there was a shipping depot where you could kind of see what people were ordering from. Everything had to go through the shipping depot. And I would go down there and just kind of snoop around every once in a while just to kind of like get a sense, like, what are these NBA players like feeling is necessary to bring in? And there would be these extra large mattresses. There would be flat screen televisions. There would be exercise equipment, Peloton bikes, even, you know, arcade games. You know, the list goes on and on of the things that they were able to have delivered there. And, you know, it's a reminder of their spending power collectively as, you know, 350, you know, millionaire athletes, but also just their typical standard of living being very different from the average person's. And so, you know, I think that there were adjustments along the way. You actually had kind of like support guys on these teams who were wearing like so many different hats, right? Like one guy, he might be, you know, shagging rebounds before a game for players. And then after the games, he's going through this very careful process of laundering their clothes to make sure that, you know, the jerseys are clean and disinfected and all of that. Where at the same time, maybe he's also like helping set up the breakfast. I mean, we're hearing all these stories about guys who are being pulled in all these different directions because they didn't have their typical support staffs. They did bring most of the coaches, you know, that was good. And they only brought one executive from each team. And that's very unusual because a lot of the NBA front offices now have been expanded and you have, you know, five, six, seven, eight guys in the front office. And so there was sort of one point person decision maker for each organization. So there was adjustments, but, you know, it felt a little bit like summer camp or, you know, study abroad. It's not going to be as nice as it is at home, right? I mean, I studied abroad in Mexico and there was a few sacrifices involved in living with my house family down there. And it reminded me a lot of that experience. And for the players, they really keyed in on how can they keep their exercise routines and their stress management routines as similar as possible and ramp them up in some cases. I remember seeing a lot of players meditating before games, deep breathing exercises, and spending a lot of their free time just getting shots up and trying to stay in a good groove. And the nice part for them was no travel, so that, you know, gave them a little bit more free time as well. But, you know, it was challenging to fill those Groundhog Day moments as well. I mean, a lot of guys said they spent too much time on social media and reading too much criticism about their play, and it would get in their head a little bit. So, you know, in some cases, guys were kind of blacking out from the social media experience and just trying to, maybe if it's video games or riding bikes around campus, just do whatever they could to fill that time and to find that balance. Hmm.
Yeah, at some point, I think you say the bubble was not for everyone. That is, some players adapted to it much better than others did. Your book includes an exhaustively detailed, fascinating account of what it was like to be in quarantine. I mean, in incredibly strict quarantine upon your arrival. And this is, of course, what everybody else was experiencing. And only after seven consecutive days of testing negative for COVID, finally, could that quarantine be lifted? And you were still, of course, restricted in your movements, but not restricted to a single room. And eventually, of course, you begin to enjoy at least a little bit of a wider life. And, of course, eventually, basketball gets to be played. In fact, 88 games over 16 days, no days off. I mean, right off the bat. You tell us that you actually had to make a decision about which games to take in, that there were, in a sense, far more games being played than there were reporters available on site to cover them. Explain to our listeners the decision you ultimately made about that.
Well, you know, I was trying to pace myself because I am, you know, I have a tendency to, you know, I'll suffer for some burnout every once in a while because I just love the sport so much. And you can only be in one place at one time, right? And so I was wanting to rush back and forth between these arenas. So I finally told myself, hey, look, try to go to about two games, maximum three games per day. You know, slow and steady wins the race here. And my proudest achievement actually is I went to every single playoff game from the second round of the playoffs on, because at that point there was only two games per day. And that's a feat that will never be matched ever again unless there's another bubble scenario. And so that's like my pride and joy, is like, hey, you know, it's kind of like Cal Ripken's streak, you know, showing up for, you know, 21-31 straight games in baseball. I mean, that's kind of how, you know, I felt about that. You know, ultimately there was so much basketball, it was overwhelming. You know, there were certain days, like take the day of the shutdown for the Bucks, for example, there was eight Hall of Fame players scheduled to play over an 8-hour period in that one day, you know, between Giannis will be a future Hall of Famer, LeBron, Anthony Davis, Damian Lillard, Carmelo Anthony, James Harden, Russell Westbrook. I mean, Chris Paul. It was just an embarrassment of riches. And so I would try to, you know, hone in on the teams I thought were most likely to go deep in the playoffs because they were going to be the most important to the overall story. And then, you know, from there, it was just a matter of, like, you know, logistical scheduling. The great part was that the arenas were right next door to each other, so you could just walk from one to the next to the next. And, you know, again, it did feel like an AAU tournament. I played basketball back in middle school for a team called the Beaverton Running Beavers, and we'd go to these tournaments and spend all day, and you could watch your opponents play, and, you know, eventually it would be your turn to play. Sometimes you'd get two games in the same day. And it brought back a lot of memories for me of that childhood spent playing basketball. And a number of players, including LeBron, also brought up that AAU comparison. But the difference was this was an AAU tournament with Hall of Famers, right? I mean, it's just the best of the best, cream of the crop. And that's why it was such a special experience. Hmm.
We need to spend a couple of minutes talking about what in many respects was the most dramatic moment within this bubble season, namely the shooting of Jacob Blake, which I might add for your benefit, Mr. Gulliver, occurred about 10 blocks from where I'm sitting right now in our studios. Mm. So this is a story that strikes very close to home in more ways than one. And in the wake of that shooting of Jacob Blake, of course, news reached the NBA players living in the bubble, and the decision was ultimately made by the Milwaukee Bucks to not take the court for a game against the Magic. And you were there in the stands for that game, and you were in the building as hours went by. With the Bucks in their locker room before finally they emerged to make a statement that evening. Do you have any idea what went on over the course of those hours that the players were in their locker room?
Well, I will always say this. The most memorable playoff game I've ever covered is the one that didn't take place, you know, and that's going to be true, I think, for the rest of my career writing about basketball. It was an unbelievable experience, completely surreal. And I try as hard as possible in this book to break it down almost minute by minute, kind of in TikTok fashion, so that you can kind of go with me as we're piecing together what's taking place. I got to the arena, looked up at the court, saw one team on the court, one team not on the court, and said, oh boy, something's happened here. Something big is happening here. And there was no forewarning. You know, there was not any sort of a press statement that we're not going to take the court. It was a spontaneous and pretty impromptu decision by the players not to do it. There had been some chatter in the days ahead of guys on various teams saying it didn't sit right with them, the Jacob Blake shooting, that they felt like they just couldn't play. It wasn't the right time. It, you know, they felt almost like, I don't know if they were insulting Jacob Blake's family if they took the court, but it was that kind of sense, right? Like a disgust with America, this idea that, look, you know, these things keep happening and we're just going to take the court like it's normal. We heard that from a number of players. Once I was walking around the arena trying to piece together exactly where were they and what were they doing, I walked by the Orlando Magic locker room first, and I could see just bewilderment on the faces of all the players. And that's when it hit me. This wasn't a coordinated thing. This was just the Milwaukee Bucks deciding, hey, we've had enough. We're not taking the court. Kenosha's not very far from where we play our games. One of the players on the Bucks, Sterling Brown, had actually been a victim of police brutality by the Milwaukee Police Department a few years earlier, so it was obviously very personal to him and to their organization as well. And so they were holed up in their locker room. And again, this is not an NBA quality locker room. And this is almost like a glorified storage closet that they had converted into a locker room. And so a good old fashioned stakeout set up right outside. We waited for them to come out and make their statement. It took about 3 hours. We could hear speakerphone conversations taking place, but we couldn't really hear exactly what was being said. We found out later they were on the phone with the Attorney General of Wisconsin trying to figure out what legal remedies there were in the aftermath of the Jacob Blake situation. And then they also talked to Jacob Blake Sr., the father of the man who was shot, and, you know, essentially expressing their support for him. And I think also, you know, he was very grateful, as he said later in interviews, for their stance on his son's behalf. But things unfolded very rapidly from there, because you had a number of athletes in other sports follow the Bucks' lead. So you saw canceled practices or games, whether it was the WNBA, baseball, football. I mean, it spread very, very quickly, and it also became politicized very quickly. I mean, one of my tweets about their decision not to take the court was retweeted by AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she's hailing this as a major moment of labor activism, essentially calling it a strike and saying, you know, they're taking it to their owners. And then, you know, not too long later, you've got Jared Kushner, advisor to President Trump, weighing in on the players' actions. I believe Obama and Biden also tweeted about the decision not to take the court. I mean, this became kind of ground zero for the American and global political media. And these are just basketball players essentially who said, hey, look, we just can't play today, period, right? Mm. And so unfolding all of their motivations and their timing became the challenge. And ultimately, the conclusion that I reached was this was not some major statement against the ownership. You know, to say this was a labor move against their bosses wasn't quite right. This was more of a statement towards the country and towards the justice system and towards, you know, minorities around the world saying, hey, look, enough is enough. You know, we're not okay with this. And ultimately, after 3 days of talks, they did start to play games again. But those were tense conversations in terms of, you know, is it a good idea to continue playing, or should we continue maybe making a protest by everybody going home and just, you know, letting everyone know where we stand? Very difficult philosophical questions for these players to weigh. Ultimately, they decided that if they were able to negotiate a new deal with the owners to cover the rest of the bubble experience, which really focused heavily on voting access and polling locations, especially in urban areas, including Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Atlanta, and others, then they would actually agree to take the court again. So it was a very charged and emotional situation. And I'll tell you this, standing just feet away from those Bucks players, they were very nervous. When they decided not to take the court, I don't think they had any idea how big of a deal it would be, or at least they probably didn't expect it as quickly as it happened, right? Because this thing took the world by storm within just a matter of a couple of hours. And if you look back at some of the photos I've taken of the experience, there's a number of guys whose eyes are focused towards the floor. They're shifting their weight back and forth, left to right. And the two players who read the statement, George Hill and Sterling Brown, I thought they did so in just beautiful fashion, and the message was excellent. But you could tell they were being very deliberate. They wanted to make sure they got the words right, probably for history, but also understanding that there was most likely going to be a major backlash, and I think there was. And, I look back on that as an incredibly stressful time period for me personally, you know, writing on deadline, trying to make sure I'm being accurate and fair and expressing their viewpoints on such a delicate and personal and heartbreaking situation. And I think, you know, having the benefit of writing it again for the book, that's why I wanted to go in so much detail, so that everybody could kind of be there with me as this scene was unfolding.
It's an amazing story. And, of course, it was the biggest story in the country for a time. That is specifically that walkout by the Bucks and what was going to happen next and so on. And it did galvanize the nation's attention in an extraordinary way. And that's just one chapter in a really amazing book. But I am so glad that you probe the depths of that important story, that important chapter, to the extent that you do. The book again is titled Bubble Ball: Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season, published by Abrams Press, and the author, Ben Golliver. Ben Golliver, thank you so much, first of all, for giving the world this extraordinary book, and thank you for being my guest on The Morning Show. I am so glad we got to have this conversation.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and I really appreciate what you said earlier about the book. It really means a lot to me, and it's great to hear that. So I'm glad to chat anytime, and hopefully on better terms in some cases, given what we talked about today. But again, I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Monday on The Morning Show, we're going to be previewing the next episode of the PBS series American Experience. This one is devoted to the extraordinary life of evangelist Billy Graham and the political influence which he had over a succession of U.S. presidents. It's a very, very good film and an interesting story. I'll be speaking with the director of the film, Sarah Colt, on Monday.